Hey, all my Northern Virginia music aficionados, welcome to the podcast. I'm Andy Kyler from Reston, Virginia, and this is the 36th episode of Jams for Man. Before I get to my interview with today's guest, Barry Cover, a drummer known in the area as playing in Jarhead, but also probably well known around the globe for drumming for Vulture, I want to share with you an article that was shared with me. It's an article from the Reston Times titled Rockers Prepare to Jam for Man, with the subtitle July 21st concert scheduled for RCC, six bands to perform. And there are pictures of Veil, LDK, Split Decision, Remission, Channel, and Illusion to go with it. And my God, do they all look young. I shared the pictures on our Jams for Man Instagram site, but I thought maybe I'd read the article here for you because if you're listening already, you'll probably enjoy it. Anyway, here goes. There's not much for teenagers to do in Reston. For the past several years, that blanket statement has posed a seemingly insoluble dilemma for adults seeking convenient and affordable recreational havens for Reston's teens. The two dozen or so teenagers participating in this month's Jam for Man 3 rock concert agree. Reston's eclectic recreational amenities, which cater primarily to adults, offer little entertainment. But the problem, they insist, is not insurmountable. Teenagers don't want an expensive place which tries to offer an entertainment package, said Joe Banks, 19, a Jam for Man spokesman and guitarist with the rock group Avail. All we need are four walls and a roof with a stage so high, he said, holding his hand approximately 2 feet off the ground. If we need anything to put inside the four walls, we, the teenagers, can get it. With 15 teenage rock bands in Reston, an urgent need was a place to perform, said Reston Youth Club coordinators Pat Worsler and Bob Dim. But until last year, these youngsters had no place to play. The kids just started coming up to us for help in finding a place to play because no one was interested in letting them perform, Worsler said. We helped them find a place, and now some of the bands have gone on to become professional. With the help of the youth club, Herndon High School, and the Community Against Substance Abuse, Jam for Man gave its first sellout concert last June. A secondary performance followed in January, sponsored by South Lakes High School. The six rock bands comprising the Jam for Man 3 concert, LD Kids, Illusion, Remission, The Channel, Split Decision, and Avail, will perform between 7 p.m. and 10 p.m. Friday, July 21st at the Reston Community Center. They play classic rock, progressive, go-go, and an avant-garde genre some of the musicians with straight faces intact referred to as regressive rock. Tickets are on sale at RCC for $3. County Fire Department regulations limit attendance to 325, concert organizers say, and more than 600 youngsters attended the last concert. Approximately 300 Jam for Man t-shirts and Domino's pizza will be on sale at the concert. T-shirts at the January concert sold out within 20 minutes. Jam for Man fans should also bring a can of food, which will be donated to Reston Interface Embry-Rucker Shelter. Proceeds from ticket sales will benefit the youth club and provide a stipend to performers. Twin themes for Jam for Man 3 will be helping the homeless and saying no to drugs and alcohol, said concert spokesman Alexa Warden, who also helps manage the group Avail. The themes have been a hallmark for concerts since last year. Helping the homeless is where Jam for Man got its name, Warden said. People also started bringing clothes and Ataris, computers, and video games. When the Community Against Substance Abuse began sponsoring the concerts, organizers added an anti-drug theme. That theme was not difficult to add, partly because the bands don't normally allow drugs or alcohol at their garage performances, they say. Reston youth make a distinction between parties and concerts, said Jeff Oppenheimer, a bass player and vocalist with the Channel. When you go to a show in Reston, it's not a broken brawl, Warden said. The music is listened to and respected. That's why the groups need a place to perform around here. It's terrible to have to go to DC to hear a concert. I'm afraid just to walk out into the parking lot by myself. So, how about that journalism from John H. Pitcher, Jr., staff writer from the Reston Times, huh? Okay. Make sure to follow us on social media sites such as YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, SoundCloud, and Twitter to get more music, videos, and information about our upcoming guests, such as next week's guest, Jeff Berman of the Boyles, or other upcoming musicians such as Pat Kennedy, Sam Gunderson, Ron Winters Jr., and Davis White. Also, stay tuned for information about our anniversary show, Jam for Man 30, coming up in July. And without further ado, an interview with drummer and super dad, Barry Cover.
Hello?
Yeah, Barry, hi. So how's it going? How's your Christmas and everything?
Good. Very good. My son is stoked. He had a wonderful Christmas, so yeah, everything was great.
He's the 11th.
How about yourself? Yeah.
What are 11 years old? Is it all video games or?
Oh yeah, of course. But he's like really into. I've gotten him into like Iron Maiden and Priest and early new wave of British heavy metal stuff. So we're gonna go see Iron Maiden in July, and we got like orchestra pit tickets.
Yeah,
He was like almost crying when I gave those to him, and that was awesome.
Well, so that's
yeah,
the,
he also
that's the gateway, right? Like metal is essentially the gateway when you're young to everything else.
Seems like it, yeah.
Well, it's funny.
It was for me.
I don't know how many of the interviews you've listened to, but it's
I haven't had a chance to. I tried listening to Bubble Jug yesterday. I got like an hour through it. But yeah, I subscribed to the page at my job. So
nice.
I'll be listening to them.
Well,
yeah,
seems to be a recurring theme. It seems like that really is a gateway drug to a lot of other great music. And I'm not, you know, I have my own mixed feelings about Maiden.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I liked that kind of metal when I was younger. And I feel
right.
Like, you know, it's rare that I sort of go back to that.
Uh-huh.
But I loved it at the time.
Right, yeah, it was powerful. It was... It was an experience, you know, seeing that stuff, watching the Live After Death video over and over and over again. Even my dad, like, picked up on it. He's like, this is cool. These are great musicians.
<That's>
These
funny.
Guys can play.
My dad did not like a lot of the stuff that I brought into the house, you know.
Oh, yeah.
When it came to listening to music with my dad, it was a lot more about me discovering, you know, the good kinds of music that my dad liked rather than
mm-hmm.
turn my dad off to something. And him, you know, would always go like, Dad, check this out. Oh, no, you should be listening to this.
Right. Yeah.
Instead.
Yeah, well, I mean, my dad turned me on to a lot of great stuff. Yeah, like... Elvis, Johnny Cash, Creedence, all the 50s rockers, Jerry Lee Lewis, all that kind of stuff.
Like, it seems like he had a certain kind of southern rock thing going.
Yeah. And old country and show tunes and stuff like that. So
that
it was a breakthrough when he actually started enjoying the stuff that I was listening to. That's cool.
It, is that him being from Virginia, you think, or living in Virginia, or that's just...
Well, he was... My family's mostly, like, Maryland and western Pennsylvania. But, yeah, most of the family was centered around D.C. by the time I was growing up. Either Maryland, like, Frederick or Rockville. But then I ended up living in Fairfax in my teenage years.
West Virginia has a certain kind of, like, you know, its own sort of backwoods country thing.
Yeah, it does.
It's definitely very, like, woodsy there, very, you know, rural in a certain way.
Yeah, I mean, it's on one side of a mountain. It's mountainous all up in there.
You can see how the Jerry Lee Lewis and the Johnny Cash would sort of...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Connect.
Yeah.
So when you were 11, like, what was, you know, what was your life like as compared to, like, your son?
Let's see. When I was 11, I had grown up. I had an older brother that was 8.5 years older than me, so he had all the cool stuff when I was a kid. You know, he had, like, The Police, Van Halen, Judas Priest, Rush, all that kind of stuff. So I'd grown up listening to the early, like, you know, commercial metal. But by the time I was 11, I was really into pro wrestling. And my favorite wrestlers were the tag team, the Road Warriors, Hawk and Animal, and they would come to the ring with Black Sabbath's Iron Man. And that just, like, hit something in me that I was like, oh, my God, that is the coolest song ever. I got to look into that. So I discovered, like, Black Sabbath and Ozzy Osbourne. And I'd always, you know, heard the horror stories that these people are evil and they bite the heads off bats and they worship Satan. I was like, cool, I'm in. That sounds great. And the drumming's cool. I want to play drums. So, I mean, I was just like a normal suburban kid living in the neighborhood. And somehow I'd always known I wanted to play drums, but I finally convinced my dad around that time, probably about 12, that I really, really wanted to do it. He was like, okay, we'll do it, but you've got to buy everything, you know. So I picked up jobs here and there, doing what I could, mowing lawns or saving allowances. And by the time I was actually allowed to work, I started saving up to buy a real drum set. I bought a secondhand drum set, my first kit, in the neighborhood newspaper. I really wish I still had it because I bought it for like $150. It was a 70s jazz Gretsch drum kit. And it's probably worth a lot of money now. But of course I didn't know what I had and I trashed it and, you know, played
it taught you
thrash,
drums.
Whatever else, you know, I started learning. I think the way I learned how to play drums was listening to Metallica and like Agnostic Front. And just trying to play as fast as possible. Like Slayer, SOD, anything that was like super fast and super heavy, I was trying to get that down.
Speed! Did you ever have any formal lessons?
I took lessons maybe for a year, and it was mostly like rudimentary snare. And I tried to get into the high school band, but I wasn't experienced enough, and they started a beginning band class, and I signed up for that for my 10th grade year. And when I got to school, the first day of school that year, they had canceled that whole program, and I was in concert band, and they were like, well, you weren't at band camp. You're not in marching band. What are you doing here? And I was like, yeah, this is supposed to be beginner's class. And they said, oh, we canceled that. There wasn't much interest. So I didn't do any, like, playing in high school bands or anything, but a lot of my friends were in bands. Some of the guys you've interviewed, I'm sure, like Matt Park or Rashad Jones, all the Bubble Jug kids. We all went to the same school. So I was like a year older, maybe 2 years older than some of them, but I knew them all from middle school and just from the adjoining neighborhoods. So I knew Josh Neal and his drum kit. He took lessons the same place I took lessons at. I never really was, I tried the lessons and I just didn't get it. You know, the guy taught me pretty basic stuff, and I just was like, yeah, I want to play a whole kit and double bass. And so he moved me along into that, and I just decided I'd do it on my own from there and just practice as much as I could every day. Thankfully, I was a latchkey kid, so I got home from school before my folks did, so I could just rock out on the drums for about an hour or two every day. And then started trying to form bands in the neighborhood. Probably by the time I was in 10th grade. My first band was called Cositis, because I was reading a lot of Dante's Inferno, the Divine Comedy, and Cositis is one of the frozen lakes of hell. And I was like, that sounds awesome. We're going to do that. That's going to be a great band. Of course, putting it in on paper, everybody's like, what's cockitis? Is that some kind of venereal disease? But my first band, we played our first show at the Jamfer Man in Reston with Midair Goose Collision, Branch Manager, and Avail. I think it was 92.
And that was with Cositis?
Yes, that was Cositis. That was our first show.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't even know how we got hooked up with Patty Worsler, but that was our first show.
What do you remember from that show?
I remember it being awesome. Like, it was like Avail had just come back from Richmond. What was to be known as Avail lineup, not the Reston Avail, but the Tim Berry led Avail. And it was, like, awesome to us to see that, you know, like, wow, they're just regular dudes. Cool. And the drummer borrowed my China cymbal. That's the day I met Eric Larson right there. And I wouldn't say we were friends, you know, then, but we are now. Like, I live in Richmond now. He lives here. I've been here for 23 years. But yeah, it was awesome. We're playing in front of a crowd. This is what we wanted, but we sucked. We did do a pretty decent cover of Slayer's Seasons in the Abyss.
Thank you.
But, you know, we were the band that stuck out. You know, we were like the shitty thrash band playing with the cool underground wrestling bands.
it sounds like a lot of fun, and I mean that's a great lineup.
Yeah, it was cool. It's funny. I took my son to see Branch Manager last year when they played here in Richmond, and we were talking with the drummer, and I was like, "Yeah, man, my first band's first show was with you guys at the Jam for Man." And he was like, "Whoa! Oh my God! Wow!" It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I got to talk to them at some point too.
Yeah, because man, they hit it off. Like I remember going up to see them in Philly, opening for Fugazi at like the Electric Factory, pretty huge place. Like, wow, this guy's. Got on Discord and we're doing something.
Yeah. Well, but, I think part of it was they kept it going.
Yeah, exactly. You know? I learned that later in life. If your band has longevity, you end up doing something.
Yeah, I think to some extent that's half the battle is just keeping the band
keeping it together. Yeah.
You know, and trying to keep somewhat of a consistent lineup, you know, and being able to maintain somewhat of a consistent band identity.
Mm-hmm.
So that people can discover you also.
Yeah.
But yeah, it helps to get hooked up with the label, you know, it helps to have...
Well, of course.
You know, especially at that time... A label like Discord behind you. I know a lot of other bands at least reached out to Discord, you know, to gauge their interest.
Right.
Because that seemed to a lot of people to be the only option. It was like Discord
right.
Plus. It was like either we're going to be able to play the DC scene too, or, you know, let's break up because there's nowhere to play.
Right. Yeah, it was, man, that was weird times because, like, yeah, you couldn't really get into the DC scene because you couldn't really play with Discord bands, like, I remember when Rancid was, like, starting to get buzz going, and Black Cat was a new club, and Rancid came through, and they opened for Hoover. And it was a completely weird show, because Hoover's crowd was not a Rancid crowd.
Never ask you, come in my room, you weren't invited in. Play with my toys. Never asked you play with my private life. So don't never ask you take me to war. Keep it right to yourself.
Hoover was awesome, by the way. I love Hoover. They were a great Discord band, but it was just funny seeing, like, people looking at Rancid, like, oh, is this a thing now? Punk rock is back again? Like, what are these guys doing? And then, you know, the next year, Rancid's, like, fucking huge.
You know what else I've noticed is there seems to be, because Rancid is kind of like this. Like they have somewhat of a ska element to them.
Uh-huh.
You know, and there seems to be a real connection between like ska music and sort of reggae music and hardcore punk.
Yeah, definitely.
And I, you know, a lot of it, I guess, can be traced back to the Clash.
Or even further back than that, like
the
69 skinheads, you know, like the Rude Boys skinheads from the late 60s that were all into ska and reggae and dancehall. I mean, that all spawned from, like, the mods before that into the mid-60s stuff. But
the mods were into reggae or rocksteady?
No, but that whole culture, like, kind of spawned either you were a mod or a rocker, and then the mods would wear like Fred Perry and Doc Martens and ride scooters and stuff. And then skinheads started doing that when the skinhead culture came into play. And then like, but I think, I don't know the full history of the skinhead, but the skinheads weren't really into the punk scene until the late 70s when they were, skinheads became like Nazis, but there were still other skinheads that were older skinheads, like, you know, into the reggae stuff and hung out because they lived in like black poor neighborhoods, you know, working class. Like, that was their neighborhood. They weren't racist at all. But that the look and that culture and the attitude of like starting bar fights and all that came into play into the punk scene from those scenes. but this isn't about that history.
No, I know. But I just in seeing these connections, in listening to these bands' music, you'll hear like, you know, punk bands covering reggae songs or ska songs.
Oh yeah, I mean Jarhead was all up in that. Like we worshipped NOFX and Propaganda and like all and the Toasters and Murphy's Law, all those ska bands, Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, like all that stuff was so hot. Okay, so when I was in Cositis, we probably lasted about a year and a half and had a breakup and got two new members in the band, and one of them was, or actually both of them were these guys from Centerville High School that I didn't really know too well, and one of them was Brian Collins, and he was just the coolest guitar player I'd ever seen and played with, and he just turned me on to so much cool music. You know, I was still just in the metal and just getting into like punk rock and hardcore, and Brian's turning me on to like, oh, you need to listen to Jimi Hendrix, Electric Ladyland with headphones on in the dark. And I'm like, what? He's like, just do it. Just listen to it. You gotta like, don't be distracted by anything. You just gotta hear how the album is produced and how it sounds and how it's engulfed and mixed in headphones. And I was like, what are you talking about, man? He's like, just trust me and listen to it. And he's like turning me on to like early ZZ Top and like, you know, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Grand Funk Railroad, like all these cool bands. Like, oh, this is all just radio rock. No, these are great bands that you need to hear. So we start listening to all this other stuff and our metal band is just not doing so well, and bass player ends up quitting, so it's like a whole new lineup. We get this other bass player, Paul, and we go maybe another 6 months, and then Brian and I are like, yeah, this sucks, let's start doing this punk rock stuff. instead of trying to play it sound like Pantera or Testament or whatever. So we just changed it up and went as a three piece with this new bass player, Paul, and we decided to call it Jarhead. And nothing to do with the Marine slander or term. I don't know why Brian even thought of it. I think he thought it was racist and edgy, but I was like, no, dude, that's what Marines call each other. But it stuck, and we started writing new songs. I think our first gig was the Chantilly High School talent show, and we tried out. I remember Bubble Jug trying out right before us, and the band director was like, what am I looking at? What is this? No way. You guys can't be in here. And he turned them down, and I don't know how he picked us, because we were pretty bad, too. Probably just because we didn't have three singers and horns and chaos going on. He just didn't know what Bubble Jug was trying to do. And I think, yeah, our first real gig, like, as Josh said, was the Mountain Lodge in Georgetown. I think I have a flyer for it. I have a bunch of old flyers and photos and stuff, but it's not organized. Yeah, okay. May 29th at the Mountain Lodge in Georgetown. I'm guessing that was 93.
Nice.
I think, yeah.
How many songs did you guys have at that point?
I don't know, maybe a dozen with a bad cover of Sweet Child of Mine. Like, probably three times as fast, and then in the middle breakdown, we turned it into a ska part.
What were the best of, like, those songs?
What were the facts?
No, the best of those songs that you had.
Oh, what were the best of those songs?
Yeah.
Geez, I don't know. I think we had a song called Kimmy Gibbler that was pretty cool. Geez, yeah, I don't remember the earliest songs. Maybe, I think we had a song called Get Up and Go. But I ended up replacing Paul with my really good friend, Jason Midoff, who I met, like, first day in high school. And he was wearing, like, a Nuclear Assault hat and a Sacred Reich shirt or something like that. And I was just like, okay, cool, we're going to be friends. Let's trade tapes and thrash metal and all this stuff. And he ended up getting into punk and hardcore and ska and all that. So we all just kind of switched over from metal to West Coast pop punk. That's what we were going for. We wanted to sound like NoFX. I never talk to my neighbors. I never talk to my neighbors. I never talk to my neighbors.
I never talk to my neighbor. I never talk to my neighbor.
so when Jason joined, that's when we started writing everything, and things just started falling into place. The music store came around. We were playing Dharma Coffee House in Fairfax. Started, I think, where else? Early on, we were doing house shows. Then we just started branching out, started playing Club Asylum a lot downtown. Started going into Baltimore, playing Memory Lane a lot. We played The Loft at one point. Getting into the scene with the Suspects and the Goons, the Rejects, Positive State, Shout Bus, all those great bands formed our own little scene. Lickety Split came along, and the 22s. It was just good times, man. Jarhead would play wherever. And I think our shtick was, let's get as drunk as we can before we go on and see what happens. And that was our thing. Like, people came to see us to see how drunk we were or to see how silly our show was. Or sometimes it would be a great show. Very rarely, but we played some really good ones.
what do you think all the bands that were in that scene kind of had in common? What do you think united you guys?
A sense of community, most likely. I mean, we would, like, we had record convergence. And I know I'd ran into so many people there, like, oh, I know you. You're from Reston. Oh, you're from Herndon. You're from Centerville. Or you're from Burke or whatever. We had that, and we just had, everybody would look out for each other, like, oh, let's get these guys on the gig. That'll be a good gig for them. Or, hey, they're playing a house show. You guys want to jump on? You guys want to go up to Baltimore with us? Or, it was all friends. We all just made a community.
And how did you get your music out there other than, like, playing? Did you guys record? Did you any 7-inch?
Yeah. We did our first 7-inch at Clear Sound in Manassas, which was basically in this guy's basement, his parents' basement. He was saving up to buy it. Rent his own studio or whatever, but we caught him on the ground floor, and it was cheap for us, affordable. So we were able to do it. We recorded the Jarhead 7-inch with, it was a 5-song 7-inch, but they didn't fit the 5th song on there. So there's 4 songs on it. Lazy America, Stupid Drunk, what else is on there? The song Disgruntled Employee. Yeah, that's it. But that session, we recorded like 8 songs, I think. Maybe 9. And the other ones weren't ever released, but everybody knew them because we played them live all the time. We just gigged around forever, and then ended up doing, towards the end of Jarhead, we recorded at Christian Quick Studio in Warrington, at, in the backside of the Drum and Strum Music Store. It was a real cool studio, real laid back, and we just made a weekend out of it, We would just stay there. Brian was in awe because he was allowed to use any guitar on the wall in the music store, and there were, like, some cool vintage guitars. So we just, like, there were percussion instruments everywhere, We were encouraged to use anything we wanted to. We just stayed in there for like a whole weekend, just drinking and making that tape. We released it on a cassette tape because it was too expensive for us to make an LP, and nobody wanted to pick it up. We did send it to Fat Records, and they loved it and said, if you guys are a serious band and are touring, please look us up when you're out this way. But we never toured. We played New Jersey a few times. After we broke up and I moved down to Richmond, we got back together and played a gig in Richmond. We played a gig at, Charlie and Billups' old house in Burke, I think. I don't know if that had a name, the house had a name or not. We recorded that last recording, and it was like an hour long, so it probably wouldn't even fit on a whole LP anyway, even if we could have pressed it. But of course there were like outtakes and banter in between all the songs.
So what was the vibe like for you guys, the three guys throughout?
It was great. Like I said, Jason and I had been really good buds since like first day of school in ninth grade. And then once I met Brian, I hung out with him so much. Did lots of drugs together, and, you know, he turned me on to so much cool music and styles. Like, we went to so many shows, just random stuff, you know. He encouraged me to listen to everything but the music we were playing, you know. Like, check out what's happening elsewhere, you know, hip-hop or old R&B and, let's go see John Spencer Blues Explosion. We went to see them like six times. Every time they were just the best live band you could ever imagine seeing. And then, you know, we were starting to get influences from that. So we weren't just playing the style and NoFX Bad Religion sound anymore. We were starting to like use, you know, the song, sounds from other influences. Well, we've all lost touch. I've reconnected with Jason on Facebook recently in the past couple years. Brian, I would run into every now and then he would come through Richmond, or I would see him down in North Carolina when he lived in Chapel Hill. He's since moved to Tampa and became a high school teacher. And now he's in L.A. because he wanted to move to Hollywood and make it big in the music business. But he's also a school teacher, and he's not on social media. I haven't talked to him in years. I've just heard this through other friends, that he's out in L.A., and he's a school teacher.
Well, that sounds familiar.
Yeah. So he's closer to you. But
I'll,
yeah, he was.
I'll see if I can.
He was.
Down. Or maybe
yeah.
Run into each other at a show one of these days.
Right. Yeah,
or,
Brian Collins.
Cool.
Yeah, I love that guy, man. He's one of my best friends and a huge influence on me. He's the funniest dude ever.
So all of you continued to play?
Yeah. When I moved down here, I was like in a hub, like all of a sudden everybody's like, oh wow, there's this new guy. All these bands need drummers. So within the first year I lived here, I was in two bands already. And then by the second year I was here, I was doing four bands at one point.
Jesus.
So yeah, I ended up doing a lot, right away. Formed a band called Wiseacre that sounded a lot like the San Diego sound, like Drive Like Jehu kind of stuff. That was our influence. But then I've joined a band called Dime Store Hood, and then we changed it to Wheelbite. We had a rotating bass player problem. We went through like seven bass players, but at one point Jason from Jarhead was our bass player, briefly. I don't know if he's continued to play music or not, because he got really big into bicycle racing. And he's gone all around the world racing bikes. And he's also in California now. I think middle California. But, yeah, he's a big cyclist.
There's good
weather. Oh, yeah, I'm sure. And the mountains. God, it's gorgeous out of there, yeah. I'm not sure if he kept up with music as much as Brian and I did, but yeah, Brian was doing a band with Matt Park from our neighborhood, or Josh and Scott Hawkins' neighborhood, really, not my name. My neighborhood was next to their neighborhood. They were in a band in Chapel Hill called Opening Flower Happy Bird. And they were a great band. Connected in L.A. to start a new band, but it just didn't work, so Matt ended up moving to Germany, and now he's in Portland. He left Germany, so he's probably making music in Portland now. Brian, I don't know what he's doing. I'd love to hear what he's doing because I have all of his stuff while we were in Jarhead together or after Jarhead. He always had solo recordings. So he sent me like everything he recorded. And it's just brilliant music. The guy's a great songwriter and can play the hell out of guitar. He's got a great singing voice. So, I mean, yeah, I'm a huge fan of him. I'd love to get back in contact with him. But yeah, we were always close. You know, I always had so much respect for him for just turning me on to all kinds of music. So,
well,
sorry, I just rambled there. I did go.
That stuff.
Since I've been here, I did, Wheelbite, and I joined this band Lycosa. I was in this band Kojak that actually went around the country a few times. We played with PCP Roadblock a lot. That was also another Northern Virginia band that moved to Richmond. Let's see, then I was in Amoeba Men. I was in Immortal Avenger. I played with Municipal Waste for a European tour. I drove them on a tour in the U.S. I played for the Goons on two separate occasions. I did a tour with them around the country. And then we were going to do a live recording on the radio with old and new stuff, like a whole discography, like one set live. And I went up to rehearse with them for a month or so, and that fell through, and ended up playing a show with them next door to CBGB's at the Gallery in New York. It was some big fest. So, yeah, I played for the Goons on two separate occasions. And then I was in this band, Vulture. I got to go over to Europe a couple times and put out. We had a record on Heavy Artillery, which is a German label. Another record on another label, which escapes me right now. But yeah, that was cool. That was like back to my roots, playing stuff just like Priest and Maiden, playing in, you know, big metal festivals or headlining small clubs and pubs around England. That was cool, and that was great. But yeah, after all that, I kind of fizzled out. I got a DUI and happened to be going through a divorce at the same time, so that took a lot out of me, and I was working two jobs to try to support all my bills and court fees and lawyer and all that kind of stuff. So I ended up just not playing drums anymore. And I'm fine with that. I have my drums set up in my son's room for the past, like, 4 years. He never took any interest in it. But he is a showman. He wants to be a front man. So last year for his 10th birthday, he wanted to play a show. So I had to form a band for him to play a show. And, of course, most of his songs were about Minecraft or other video game references. But we did a three-song set and a cover of the Scorpions' Rock You Like a Hurricane. So that was the last time I really played drums with anybody. Last year, just briefly for about a month, practice. But at the same time, I had also shown my son Iron Maiden about a year ago, and instantly he was like, oh, I want to play bass. So I was like, all right, and I bought him a bass. And then eventually an amp, so he's slowly tinkering with that while playing violin in the school orchestra as well. So I'm not against playing music. I'm just happy doing my thing, watching my son grow, and him get interest. And it's it all comes back around in the circle. It's like watching my childhood over again. He's getting into all the same stuff I was getting into. So I want to steer him in direction and show him all kinds of different things. You don't have to be so close-minded. Like my big thing now, I'm a chef now, and I work two jobs. So I'm pretty busy. And when I'm not working, I have him. I have my son here, so I just spend my days off with him, and it's great, and I get to see the world again through his eyes, and it's awesome.
I mean, the fact that you would put together a show just for your son, just for his birthday, put together a band so that he could do that, I mean, that shows what kind of dad you are, and that's amazing.
Cool. Good, yeah, I thought it was awesome, too.
I think that's the coolest thing that I've heard in a while. That is great, Barry.
Awesome. At the same time, I wanted it to be a lesson to him, like, okay, so I did this for you, but next time you're going to have to form your own band, and you're going to have to get along with your band members and work together. Like, I'm not always going to be able to do this for you.
Yeah,
the life you choose, which I don't really suggest doing it, because there's not much money or notoriety or fame in it. But there might be if you're pretty good. Who knows? Or, you know, if you put on a show. I didn't care that, you know, we didn't get paid on tour and didn't have gas money to make it to the next gig. That didn't bother me at all. Like, that stuff was cool. Like, okay, now we've got a challenge. What do we do? How do we get there? How do we sell our stuff today so we can make it to the middle of Montana? Like, yeah, those experiences were great, and I'm not salty about the music business. I know how it works, and I love the underground aspect of it, and it's fine, you know. I'm not bitter, but I don't want my son to go into it thinking like, oh, you can make money and be famous and do all this stuff, and it's real easy. It's not easy at all. You gotta bust your ass, like most things in life.
take it. I'm gonna feel.